Today is June 10th, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro. Before we get underway, thanks to those of you who voted for the show at Podcast Alley. We got under 300 for the first time. So, hey, let's keep it up for the month of June. This month, I'm hoping everybody's going to head over there. The link is up at the show notes, as it always is, at macobserver.com/roundup. Go ahead and vote. It helps out with exposure for the show. And hey, if we really knock it out of the park this month, there's no need to make a big deal about it in the future, next month. So yeah, during June, head over there, vote for the show. And again, if you've already done that, thank you. Thank you very much. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast or to find that voting link, you can visit the show notes at macobserver.com/roundup. There's an interesting collection of stories this week, and Brian Chaffin will be with me in the context machine to talk about them. But first, let's do the news. This story caught my eye as a particularly interesting one, and potentially as being a really big deal. The One Laptop Per Child project expects to have a computer costing about $135 US available to children in developing countries by the middle of 2007. One Laptop Per Child leader Nicholas Negroponte hopes that economies of scale will bring the cost down to $100 by 2008 and $50 by 2000 or by 2010. One Laptop Per Child has been working with such partners as Red Hat, Google, AMD, Marvel Technology, Nortel Networks, eBay, and some others to build a rugged, Linux-based laptop that weighs about 2 pounds and requires about 2 watts of power. However, users will have to turn a hand crank to get the machine going. It'll be located either on the laptop itself or on its AC power adapter. The laptop will feature a sealed keyboard and 3 USB ports to protect them from water and dust, as well as a 500 megahertz processor and a 7x4-inch LCD. It also includes fold-out antennas that will connect to the internet via cheap satellite dishes and distributed, and the antennas themselves, will be distributed as well by One Laptop Per Child. The organization will also make available a $100 server with a 200 gigabyte storage drive. Brazil, Thailand, Argentina, and Nigeria have committed to buying 1 million of the laptops next year, with China, India, and Egypt apparently expressing interest. Mr. Negroponte said that 30 state governors have also inquired about them. Now here's my favorite story from the week. When Apple Computer announced that it was abandoning the PowerPC as a processor, some analysts questioned why Apple chose to use processors from Intel over those from AMD. Plenty of people in our forums and in comments to our articles have also expressed a similar confusion. Well, the answer to that question now seems to be unfolding as benchmarks are starting to appear, which compare Intel's soon-to-be-released mid-range processors to AMD's higher-end chips. In an independent study conducted by Hexis.net, Intel's E6600 2.4 GHz chip, codenamed Conroe, as we've discussed it on a previous show, outperformed AMD's high-end Extreme Edition AM2-based FX62 chip. The Hexis.net report states, "It's abundantly clear that Conroe will be the fastest chip in town when it hits in a few weeks' time. It pulverizes all present CPUs in the majority of CPU-based benchmarks." Price is another factor to take into consideration with these chips. The Intel E6600 will cost about $250 US compared to AMD's FX62 at about $1,000. In the long run, of course, we can expect Intel and AMD's technologies to leapfrog each other over the years, much like ATI and NVIDIA have done in the video chipset market. In the end, healthy competition between Intel and AMD can only be a good thing for Mac users, even if an AMD chip never makes it inside an Apple product. And speaking of Intel and Apple, at this week's Computex trade show in Taiwan, Anand Chandrasekhar, I have no idea if that's actually how you say his name, senior vice president and general manager of Intel's sales and marketing group, told reporters, Apple pushes us to think about things that we might not always think about. We were hoping for that to happen, and that certainly happened. The natural assumption is that if Apple might be changing the way Intel interprets the electronics marketplace, it might also be affecting Intel's product roadmap in certain ways. And perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit in the context machine. Also this week, Apple Computer has filed another lawsuit against rival MP3 player manufacturer Creative Technology. This is yet another countersuit in a he-sued, she-sued kind of atmosphere. Not much to say here. If you're interested in the details, you can find the full article in the show notes at macobserver.com/roundup. Let's get into the context machine. All right, and so let's take a look at some of these stories. Brian Chaffin is with me in the context machine this week. Brian, welcome back.
Always good to be here, Ricky.
Let's start off with this one laptop per child program. This sounded really interesting to me when I saw it, and there are things about it that are really exciting to me. But the first question, I guess, is this project for real? Is this a serious project, or is this kind of fluff and pandering? Hey, we're going to give people, you know, $100 laptops, and it's going to revolutionize the world. Is this a big deal, or is this not a very serious thing?
I think it's a pretty big deal in a number of ways. Even if this project specifically were to fall flat on its face, there seems to be a lot of things that they're testing out and, you know, are actually making work. For instance, the idea of a $135 laptop, and that's pretty revolutionary. Now, the specs on this thing are a joke compared to a product from Apple or, you know, most of the products that you can buy from you know, Dell or any of the other toaster makers out there. But that's not really the point. These computers are, and actually let me add another preface to that. I know that a lot of people have attacked this project because there are places where the kids can't read at all, or they're just poverty-stricken to such levels that the idea of giving them, of their government giving them a laptop is so completely ridiculous as to boggle the imagination. But I don't think that these laptops are going to be going towards that extreme end of poverty. I think that they're going to be going from governments to children who can read but don't have access to computing and don't have access to the internet. And that's where it's going to have an impact, and that's where it's designed to go.
And you can imagine if there were places where, at a minimum, the kids could read, but they might not have access to good education, good high school education or secondary education or certainly college educations. There's a tremendous amount that you can learn on the internet. Of course, everything on the internet is true.
This is well known, yes.
but you know, with the understanding that there's a lot of stuff that you can learn that's not true, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a tremendous amount of information that you can learn on the internet. And so just getting access to that wealth of information seems in and of itself like a very big deal. And you don't need a modern computer, you know, the gigahertz processor in your computer in order to get on the internet and find some of that information.
I am a huge proponent of spreading information, which is perhaps may seem to be somewhat of a contradiction in that I am also a proponent of well-managed intellectual property laws, which we don't necessarily have in this country, but that's another issue entirely. but the point is, putting information in the hands of people, putting information in the hands of kids is a good thing. And I think that for the tens of millions of, you know, if not hundreds of millions of kids in poverty-stricken countries that can read, that can actually make use of computers like this, this is just a fantastic idea. Even if it's running Linux, even if it's a small 500 megahertz processor, even if the storage capabilities are limited, it is still going to be a massive step up for a lot of people.
Now, you talked about spreading information, and I think I've heard you talk a lot about freedom of information. I noticed that China has expressed an interest in these laptops, and it's worth taking a moment to talk a little bit about the situation there. China has been very active in censoring internet access and the content that you can get to. There's one of the most public stories recently
within China.
One of the most public stories was that Google and the other search engines have allowed the amount of content that they provide through their search engines to be clipped, to be trimmed by the Chinese government. Now, these laptops, in theory, are going to work with satellite connections. There's talk about having these wireless modems. Is there reason to believe that those modems, because they're going to be satellite connections, won't be subject, if these computers were in China, that they wouldn't be subject to that kind of censorship?
Well, first of all, I'm going to make it plain that I'm not an expert in either the censoring technologies or China's policies, but my thought on that is that if China buys these things, they will be able to control the content. That they won't turn around and buy these for anyone unless they can control the content, because they are a bunch of controlling pieces of crap.
And that does seem reasonable. I mean, one of the comments, I forget who it was in the exact wording of the comment, but one of the comments that came out of Google when they agreed to subject themselves to the will of the Chinese government in this respect was, they said, you know, this is the price of doing business here. You have to be willing to put the content in the control of the Chinese government in order to be here. So it sounds like that seems like the most reasonable argument. China would never buy into this, I think you're saying.
Yes, and unless as for that, by the way, Google's motto is to do no evil, or do no evil, or I can't remember the exact wording, but
don't be evil.
I think that compromise that they made with their own ethics was in fact an evil act.
And let's move on to one of the other big stories from the week. We're starting to see benchmarks now come out on the Conroe chip from Intel. I'm curious, first of all, how much do you believe these benchmarks? The chip hasn't even been released publicly yet. It was a third-party benchmark, but how much do you believe that these things really do totally crush the high-end AMD chips that are out?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that looking at the benchmarks, they don't totally crush the AMD processor. They just beat them in most everything, and in some categories they do crush them. But there were some categories that I've got them up in front of me now, but there are a couple of categories that that AMD's FX62 beats the Conroe. Memory bandwidth, as a matter of fact, is one of them. And there were so with that in mind, my vaguely educated guess is that these benchmarks are probably going to be fairly spot on. I'm sure that Intel provided the prototypes for this purpose. So I'm sure that these benchmarks are going to represent actual shipping units at some point.
Fair enough. Now, you said they don't crush the AMD chip, so it sounds like this is not going to end.
Don't totally crush the AMD benchmarks. They do spank the AMD in several categories, but AMD beats them in a couple of things. So I was just quibbling over the idea that they totally crush the AMD processor.
Now there's a lot of vitriol, and there's a lot of passion out there on the internet about AMD versus Intel. Depending on where you go, you will get people saying all kinds of stuff. It's not
kind of vaguely reminiscent of Intel versus PowerPC, huh?
Surprise. This is not going to end the debate about who makes the better processors, right? This is gonna go on over time, and over time the balance of power will shift. And this is not, I mean, it's not like something has ended here with the or will end with the release of the Conroe chip. We're just at another stage.
We need to hope that that's the case. We need to hope that this doesn't end any kind of debate. AMD is a much smaller company than Intel. And, you know, they're scrappy and they put out some just fantastic products. And the Mac platform will benefit from AMD and Intel being at it for a long time to come. Whether or not we ever see an AMD chip in a Mac is irrelevant.
Now let's talk about the Intel chip that we expect to see in a Mac. Conroe, the conventional wisdom is that Conroe will be the chip that drives the successor to the PowerMac G5.
It seems to be the case, yes.
And does that sound promising to you? I mean, does it seem like a worthy successor, whatever that means, to the G5?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I have a PowerMac G5, and it's just an absolutely fantastic machine. You know, whether or not you and I like it, however, Apple has gone with Intel, and it seems like Conroe is going to be just an absolutely fine chip. Now, whether or not it's truly going to be as fine as where IBM might have taken the G5 had Apple not ceased doing business with them, well, we'll never really know that, I suppose. But it does seem like the Conroe chip is going to be a good chip for us.
There was one other thing I wanted to ask you. The PowerMac G5, we're reaching the end. By the end of the summer, people expect that the PowerMac G5 will be an old product of Apple rather than a current product. Would you say that as a machine, as a pro desktop computer, that it was a success as a product?
Isn't that a good question? As some of our listeners may no, I made a bet with John Keat, who writes the Devil's Advocate column. We called it the bet, with a capital T and a capital B, where I said that the G5, the PowerMac G5 in particular, was going to finally boost Apple's market share in the computer world, and it did not. I lost that bet. I really actually haven't owned up to it publicly. At least the way I was supposed to, which was to, I think I was supposed to pay John $25 and admit some band that I was embarrassed to like. But be that as it.
Do you want to tell us what that band is right now, or are you going to wait to do that with John?
You know, I probably should go on record. I kind of like a little bit of ABBA sometimes.
Oh, Brian likes the ABBA. All right, so you lost the bet. It didn't boost the market share, but was it? Does that mean it was not a successful product?
Well, the product itself was a great product. I mean, Apple put out a fantastic professional machine out there, but for whatever reason, they didn't ever sell a ton of them. I don't think Apple's ever been really happy with the sales of the PowerMac line since it introduced the G5. I don't think it ever did as well as it should have. I don't think it ever did as well as we expected it to. But the machine itself is a fantastic machine. The one I have is the dual 2.7. I don't have the quad 2.5, but the dual 2.7 is just, you know, it's a fantastic machine. It's fast. It plays games great. It's you know, does anything that I ask in a very brisk manner. So the product was a very good product. Apple did a great job of introducing a very good product, but the marketplace didn't necessarily jump all over it. And there are a variety of reasons for that, I'm sure. But it remains to be seen if it really, I think what it remains to be seen is how much the pro desktop is really relevant to today's market than it does with Apple's implementation. If the company sells a boatload of Intel pro machines, then we can know that there was some aspect of the G5 that the market found lacking.
And that will be very interesting. We should talk about that sometime after that product is released, because it is a really good question. Why, if they didn't sell as many of those computers as they wanted to, was it the processor? I mean, it seems hard to believe, even at the pro level, that people are really that concerned with the processor specifically. They might be concerned with its expandability or with the size of the machine or the power usage or any number of other things, but the processor itself is not the most practical thing in the world.
At the pro level, people are seldom worried about the processor. What they're worried about is it doing its job. At the pro level, it's very interesting. It's the pro level that really cares least about the things that the chip fanatics care most about, and what they care about is being able to get their job done as fast and as best as they possibly can, because that's what makes them money. That's what makes their company money. You know, so that's what the company cares about. That's what the independent professionals think, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think that's the case. When I say that the marketplace found the G5 lacking, I guess what I really mean, that the marketplace might have found the G5 lacking. What I really mean is that did Apple not sell as many pro desktops as it might have otherwise because people were not buying Macs at all? They were buying Windows machines. Could the Intel chip change that? I don't know.
And we'll just have to wait and see, I guess. Very briefly, there was this other comment related to the Intel-Apple thing. This comment from an Intel exec saying, Apple is pushing us in new and interesting ways. My first reaction to that, anytime when people get up and say, oh, this relationship with this company is, you know, working like this for us, that it's PR noise, that because there's a corporate alliance there, that they take it upon themselves to boost the other company because it's in their interest to do that. Is this comment just PR noise, or do you think it's possible that Apple is actually influencing the way Intel views the marketplace or the way it's planning its product roadmap?
Well, when I heard it, what I heard was Steve Jobs gives us headaches. that was my immediate twist on what he was saying. But no, I do think that Apple is pushing Intel in some ways. I have thought that was probably going to be the case from the get-go. I also think that a lot of what drew Apple to Intel was not the processing power that Intel offers, but was things like Intel's ability to provide chip-level digital rights management controls and things such as that, and not necessarily just the processor power. So I'm sure that a big part of this deal was Apple saying, well, this is what we need in the future. Are you going to be able to give us these things? And Intel probably told them yes. And part of that is going to be Apple pushing them in new and different ways. So I have every reason to believe that was a genuine statement.
Fair enough. And one last thing, I noticed that late Friday night or early this morning, we're recording on a Saturday, that Dr. Mac, Bob Levitis, just provided an interesting manual, and I think maybe you want to talk about this a little bit, give readers some idea of what's going on there. This seems like a good chance to kind of explain what you're doing.
Let's call it spade a spade. This is a plug for it. Apple. His name is Bob Levitis. Dr. Mac has written for us a backup guide, everything you could possibly need to know about backing up your Mac, and we've made it available in two different ways. You can view it for free on our website, like you can any of the rest of our content, but you can also download it as a PDF for $3.99 if you want to print it out or to have for offline viewing, that sort of thing. And so far, people have seemed to enjoy it. It really is a good guide. If you're not backing up your Mac, and if you think that you should be backing up your Mac, which you should, you need to check it out.
Yeah, I did look over it a little bit, and it was he makes a very good case for why it has to happen. Probably the most convincing thing is he says, look, if your hard drive goes down and you haven't backed up, you need to do this other thing where they go and they reconstruct your hard drive in a clean room. And he was talking about how expensive that is.
Oh, it's insanely expensive, yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is that I happen to be one of those people that doesn't back up their Mac. So I've been in the process of actually getting the hardware that I need to do so, and should have it in place soon. But I will be using Dr. Mac's guide myself.
Fair enough. So everyone should go check that out. And Brian, thanks for coming on the show and talking about the news.
Thanks.
As always, if you have questions or thoughts about the news, you can send them to me at roundup@macobserver.com. A lot of product announcements this week. Here's a quick roundup. Google released a Mac version of its video player application on Tuesday. It lets you play videos in full screen mode and browse scenes using thumbnail images. M-Audio has introduced a new line of mid-air wireless USB MIDI controllers and interfaces that will begin shipping this summer. Details are in the article linked at the show notes. Developer Last Day of Work Software, great name for a company, released Fish Tycoon on Wednesday. The goal of the game is to discover the seven magic fish of Isola by creating and caring for a virtual aquarium. I can't tell you how many times I've wanted to find those seven magic fish. Players learn how to care for and breed their fish in a twist on management games of a similar nature. The tank progresses in real time, which means the fish keep eating and breeding even when the computer is off. Didn't we decide that games like this were a bad idea back in the 90s after the whole Tamagotchi thing? Fish Tycoon sells for $20 US and can be downloaded through MacGameStore.com. iEntertainment Network on Wednesday announced that the World War II air combat game Warbirds 2006 is now available for download. Gamers can play for free for 2 weeks before having to spend $14 a month. PQI Corporation on Wednesday introduced Card Drive U510, a credit card-sized flash drive that offers storage capacities from 1 gigabyte to 16 gigabytes. It also features a retractable cord that connects via USB. Pricing is $50 to $140 for the 1 to 4 gigabyte drives. The 8 and 16 gigabyte versions will ship early next month. Seagate announced several products along with updated versions of the Mira Sync and Share personal server and the Pocket Drive on Wednesday. Seagate also announced new push-button backup hard drives and eSATA external hard drives. For details, again, you can follow the link through the show notes. NANS, which is spelled N-HANS with a Z, on Monday released SpeedDial, an application that lets Skype users access their accounts remotely. Pricing is $7 US with a 30-day trial available. iOGear announced the immediate availability of its 2.4 GHz wireless multimedia keyboard and mouse combo on Tuesday. It's priced at $80. And that is the product roundup. I confused myself. I thought we had something else. Hey, don't forget to vote for the show. That's all I got this week. That's the news. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. As always, our content is written by the terrific staff at TMO. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Head over to Podcast Alley, everyone. I'll see you next week. Stay subscribed. And until then, I'll see you online.